From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, I speak with poet Kenneth Koch. Painting, literature, jazz, and baseball have served as inspirations for his epic poems. Also on today's show, I speak with screenwriter and novelist William Goldman. His screenplays for Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid and All the President's Men both won Academy Awards. His screenplay for the new film, The Princess Bride, is adapted from his novel of the same name. Classical music critic Ellen Pfeiffer remembers cellist Jacqueline Dupre, who died last Monday at the age of 42. And Ken Tucker has some recommendations on home video releases. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. My guest is poet Kenneth Koch. Koch is a scholar and a fan of the great tradition of classical poetry and modern European poetry. In some of his poems, he plays with the classic form and infuses it with humor. In the New York Times Book Review, Koch was called perhaps the most polished wit writing in English, a poet writing in the discontinuous, unexpected rhythms of the Marx Brothers. In the 1950s, Kenneth Koch's circle of friends included fellow poets John Ashbery and Frank O'Hara, and painters Larry Rivers and Jane Freilicher. They collaborated on artistic projects and became known for their defiantly anti-academic stance. Some critics dubbed them the New York School of Poets. Kenneth Koch is known beyond the literary world for his earlier work teaching poetry to children and senior citizens. Since 1959, he's taught at Columbia University, where he's a professor of English and comparative literature. Penguin Books has just published his book Seasons on Earth. It includes two earlier poems, Co. and The Duplications, along with a new introduction, which he'll read from a little bit later. I spoke to Kenneth Koch earlier today from the NPR Bureau in New York. I asked him to read an excerpt of his poem The Art of Poetry from his book The Art of Love, which is a humorous homage to Ovid's The Art of Love. He told me why he wrote the poem.
Well, I don't suppose poets usually really know completely why they've written a particular poem. I know what happened before I wrote the poem. One thing that happened was I'd worked for almost 3 years on a considerably longer poem called The Art of Love, and there'd been a lot of problems in writing that poem, and when I finally solved them, when I was finally satisfied with this poem, which is about 30 pages long, I wrote three other poems that I liked a great deal in a rather short time, The Art of Poetry, Some General Instructions, and The Problem of Anxiety. And shortly after that, I wrote a poem called On Beauty, too. That is, once I'd mastered this kind of, or for myself as well as I could, this tone of being writing a poem and yet seeming to give instructions at the same time, it was easy for me to write other poems. Now, I know a lot more about writing poetry than I do about love. That is, writing poetry seems, although impossible, a little more manageable than love to me. Or at least I know more about it. And one thing that probably went into my writing The Art of Poetry was that I'm used to thinking about it since I've been writing poetry for so long, and I've taught it a lot. Maybe particularly before I wrote any of these instructional poems, I had been doing a certain amount of teaching of children to write poetry. And it wasn't so much the teaching of children that inspired the sort of instructional style of these poems, I think, as it was the essays that I wrote about the teaching, in which I was trying to show people how to do things, and also the talks I gave about it.
You know, I should ask you to read it because it's not only very interesting, but it's also very funny. So,
all right,
why don't we give it a shot?
This is the end of The Art of Poetry, which is last two pages of about a 15-page poem, in which I consider a lot of the things that bother poets and a lot of problems that come up. As to whether or not you use rhyme and how modern you are, it is something your genius can decide on every morning when you get out of bed. What a clear day. Good luck at it. Though meter is probably, and rhyme too, probably dead for a while, except in narrative stanzas. You try it out. The pleasure of the easy inflection between meter and these easy vocable lines is a pleasure. If you are able to have it, you are unlikely to renounce. As for surrealistic methods and techniques, they have become a natural part of writing. Your poetry, if possible, should be extended somewhat beyond your experience while still remaining true to it. Unconscious material should play a luscious part in what you write, since without the unconscious part, you know very little. And your plainest statement should be even better than plain. A reader should put your work down puzzled, distressed, and illuminated, ready to believe it is curious to be alive. As for your sense of what good you do by writing, compared to what good statesmen, doctors, flower salesmen, and missionaries do, perhaps you do less and perhaps more. If you would like to try one of these other occupations for a while, try it. I imagine you will find that poetry does something they do not do, whether it is more important or not, and if you like poetry, you will like doing that yourself. Poetry need not be an exclusive occupation. Some think it should. Some think it should not. But you should have years for poetry, or at least, if not years, months, at certain points in your life. Weeks, days, and hours may not suffice. Almost any amount of time suffices to be a minor poet, once you have mastered a certain amount of the craft for writing a poem. But I do not see the good of minor poetry. Like going to the Tour d'Argent to get dinner for your dog, or almost being friends with someone, or hanging around but not attending a school, or being a nurse's aide for the rest of your life after getting a degree in medicine, what is the point of it? And some may wish to write songs and use their talent that way. Others may even end up writing ads. To those of you who are left, when these others have departed, and you are a strange bunch, I alone address these words. It is true that good poetry is difficult to write. Poetry is an escape from anxiety, and a source of it as well. On the whole, it seems to me worthwhile. At the end of a poem, one may be tempted to grow too universal, philosophical, and vague, or to bring in history or the sea, but one should not do that if one can possibly help it, since it makes each thing one writes sound like everything else. And poetry and life are not like that. Now I have said enough.
I like that poem a lot. And,
thank you.
I think, you know, in many ways, you're really never solemn about poetry. You're serious about it, but never solemn about it.
I hope that's true.
You've written about wanting to be as good or better than the best old poetry and to avoid all the mistakes of bad modern poets. Why don't we start with the good old poetry? What do you love most
about... If you're going to ask me who I think the bad modern poets are, you're going to be disappointed.
naming names wasn't going to be a part of this. But what are some of the great poems of the past that made you fall in love with poetry?
Oh, I don't know. It probably started with Mother Goose. Since I started writing poems when I was about 5 years old. But when I really began to get serious about poetry, well, there were several times. Once was when I was 15, when my uncle gave me a book of Shelley and showed me some of his, my uncle's own poems. And then another stage was when at 17 I discovered modern poetry, which was really quite late for somebody to discover it. But I had a Louis Untermeyer anthology of modern poetry, and I liked most of the things in it. The poets that who've inspired me since are so many. I mean, I rather like to feel the influence of other poets, but obviously from my work, I like Byron a lot. That is the Byron of Don Juan. Among modern poets, I've gotten a lot from William Carlos Williams and Wallace Stevens and Ezra Pound, and there are a lot of French poets who've influenced me a lot, such as Apollinaire and Rimbaud and Reverdy and many others.
Well, I want to get back to what you said about wanting to avoid all the mistakes of bad modern poets. I don't want you to name names, but what are some of the dead ends that you think modern poetry run into?
Well, you know, there are things that might be dead ends for me and not for other people. All I know is what's a dead end for me. A dead end for me is trying to be, writing symbolically, having a hidden meaning in what I write, imposing seriousness on something which, that is what you, the distinction that you made about solemnity is one I like. I mean, I think my poetry is serious. There's a kind of mournfulness and longing in a lot of modern poetry that does not, I don't find convincing. It's true that I grew up in a period when T.S. Eliot was the most highly considered poet by most people I knew. And if you didn't write poetry that was not only a little solemn, but even a little depressed, it didn't seem like serious poetry. I think I found a way out of this partly in French poetry. I don't. It's very hard for me to tell you the qualities I don't like. If I had a poem in front of me, I could tell you what it is. But it's a kind of clumsy use of symbolism, a meaningless sadness and longing. Not that sadness and longing are not a part of poetry, and not that they're not a part of my poetry, but ask me something else.
Did you ever go through a period when you were younger, when you were writing bad, brooding, depressed poems, like so many of us did?
No, I don't think so. I don't think that all sad poetry is bad at all. My recent poetry is quite sad.
That's true. But I think, like, during high school when people are young, they tend to confuse... Well, they tend to just be especially brooding in their poems.
I don't blame them.
It's a tough period, huh?
Yeah.
You studied in college with Delmore Schwartz.
Yeah.
Was he your first... your first example of what leading a poet's life was?
I didn't know too much about Delmore's life. I certainly found it very inspiring to be studying with him. I liked his work and I liked him a lot. Yeah, he was the first poet that I knew, as I remember, and I didn't really get to know him terribly well.
You, shortly after college, I think, became good friends with poet John Ashbery and Frank O'Hara, with jazz musician and painter Larry Rivers. And it just strikes me as such an interesting coming together of literature and painting and music. Did you see a lot of connections between those different forms? Did you feel this shared sensibility?
Well, a good deal has been written about that period in the early and late 50s. It was terrific to be friends with such good poets as John and Frank and such good painters as Larry Rivers and Jane Freilicher. And we also knew Bill de Kooning and lots of other people. And it was a very inspiring atmosphere. I don't think I thought much about the connections between the arts. I know I spent a certain amount of time in painters' studios where there was a very free, energetic atmosphere about creating things, which I liked. And I liked the fact there was something very attractive about the painters' lives, and that they sometimes could actually sell their work and that they could actually see people looking at their work. The poet's life is rather lonely as far as the composition of poems goes. But I think I've lost the question.
Well, what did you think about when people refer to that group as the New York School? Did that mean much to you?
Well, of course, I was glad they were referring to us at all. There was not really such a thing as a New York School of Poetry in the European sense, like in France or Italy or Spain, where there was a manifesto and an announced program. But certainly there was a great deal of friendship and also a good deal of similarity in the work among Frank and John and me at the beginning. Later on, I thought our poetry, diverged quite a lot. So I don't mind if people talk about the New York School as a geographical way of talking about something. Also, there are similarities in the early work, I think.
There's a poem about your relationship with those people. The poem is called Fate. And I'd like to ask you to read the beginning of it. And it's featured in your collection of poems called Selected Poems.
Oh, okay. This is a poem about, since I'm only going to read a little of it, I went to Europe for the first time when I was in my early 20s, and my best friends, Frank and John and Jane and Larry, they hadn't been to Europe yet. Or maybe Larry was there. No, he wasn't. My best friends had not been to Europe yet, and I was all excited about my time in France, and I came back with some whiskey I'd gotten in Shannon, Ireland, where the planes used to stop, and tried to tell them how wonderful Europe was, and they wouldn't pay any attention to me because they hadn't been there and they were interested in other things. Later on, it always seemed to me this was sort of a wonderful moment in my life, though I didn't know why. I called it fate. In a room on West 10th Street in June of 1951, Frank O'Hara and I and Larry Rivers. I actually do not remember if Larry was there, but he would be there later some winter night on the stairway, sitting waiting, a demented telephone, as Frank said in an article about him. But then on the stairs, unhappy in a youthful manner, much happened later. Frank, John Ashbery, Jane Freilacher, and I. And I had just come back from Europe for the first time. I had a bottle of Irish whiskey I'd bought in Shannon where the plane stopped, and we drank it. And I told my friends about Europe. They'd never been there, how much I'd loved it. I was so happy to be there with them. And my Europe, too, which I had, Greece, Italy, France, Scandinavia, and England. Imagine having all that the first time. The walls were white in that little apartment, so tiny. The rooms are so small, but we all fitted into one and talked. Frank, so sure of his talent, but didn't say it that way. I didn't know it till after he was dead, just how sure he had been. And John, unhappy and brilliant and silly, and of them all my first friend, we had met at Harvard. They tended, except Frank, to pooh-pooh what I said about Europe. And even Frank was more interested, but ever polite, when sober. I couldn't tell it, but barely tended. They tended to be much more interested in gossip, such as who had been sleeping with whom and what I was and what was selling and going on, whereat I was a little hurt, but used to it. My expectations from my friendships were absurd, but that way I got so much out of them. In fact, it wasn't causal, but the two ways at once. I was never so happy with anyone as I was with those friends, at that particular time, on that day, with that bottle of Irish whiskey, the time 4 in the afternoon, or 3 in the afternoon, or 2 or 5, I don't know what. And why do I think that my being so happy is so urgent and important? It seems some kind of evidence of the truth, as if I could go back and take it, or do I just want to hold what there is of it now? I'll stop there. That's about the first half of it.
Thanks for reading that. I like that part where you talk about how everybody was really more interested in talking about gossip than poetry. Was that true?
Well, I didn't want to talk about poetry. I wanted to talk about how I'd felt in Europe. And since they hadn't been there, they weren't interested in talking about that. But yes, people are much more interested. We certainly were then in talking about other people than in talking about poetry.
I want to talk with you more about your poems and have you read some more, but first we have to take a short break. We'll be back after this break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live from WHYY in Philadelphia and is distributed by National Public Radio.
My guest is poet Kenneth Koch, who's joining us from the NPR Bureau in New York. And his latest book is a reissue of his poem Seasons on Earth. And there's a new poem as an introduction to this poem that he wrote several years ago. You know, for years you've managed to teach yet not be a, quote, academic, in the sense that we would use the word when we talk about academic poets.
Is that a question?
Yes.
Oh, how did I not become an academic poet?
Well, yeah, I mean, whatever the word academic means, we use it as a genre for...
How do you dance without becoming muscle-bound? I don't know. I really can't answer that question about myself. I'd have to know what you mean by an academic poet. I mean, when some people say it, it's good. When some people say it, it's bad. When some people say it, it's very bad. Usually what an academic poet means is someone who's a little tilted maybe toward criticism and scholarship instead of toward poetry. That is, that he relies more on what's been written by other people than on his own feelings, or takes what's already been written more seriously, or goes along with certain attitudes, or is afraid to experiment. I mean, I don't really know. It's hard to deal with the question.
You became a semi-celebrity for a while through your books about teaching children and about teaching senior citizens how to write poetry. And a friend of mine said he even saw you on the Merv Griffin show. Now, I can't think of a lot of poets who are on that show. What was it like for you to kind of get invited into this world where poets are seldom invited, to be written up in Time magazine and be invited onto TV variety shows?
One, I like the word semi-celebrity. That's funny. Also, too, I was not on the Merv Griffin show.
I must have seen you on another one. I was on the unreliable source.
I was on the David Frost show. He used to have a weekly show with five of my student poets. I liked that work. I've written extensively about it and would rather talk about poetry, but I mean, I like the work and I like the attention my work got, because what I really wanted to do when I did that work was to get people to teach poetry to kids in a way that would make them like it and not dislike it. So I and of course it's a lot of fun to be on TV and to get lots of mail for a while, but then you have to answer it.
You were working with children and senior citizens, getting them to use poetry as a form of self-expression. Have you ever thought as poetry as a form of self-expression for you?
I didn't think of it as that for children and old people, nor do I think of it as that for myself, because, you know, but those words are so abstract. It's hard to know what it means. I think a poem really is, it's a work of art made out of words, and certainly what one is feeling at the time one writes is, and even before one writes, but it's mainly what one feels as one writes, is very important in what goes into the poem. But I don't think poetry is any more an expression of oneself or one's feeling than a statue is, or a symphony. And I find that concept a little hard to deal with.
You strike me as perhaps one of the few writers who actually enjoys writing, or at least has during some periods.
Oh, I think they secretly all enjoy writing.
I mean, do you really?
Or almost all of them. There are moments that are really terrible, but that are very hard when you work for a long time and the work seems to be terrible and you feel you're no good. And but most writers I know enjoy writing, otherwise they wouldn't write.
Your new book is a republication of a humorous epic poem that you wrote. What year did you write Seasons on Earth?
Well, actually, my new book is called Seasons on Earth, and it's a republication of two long poems, one called Co, or A Season on Earth, and the other called The Duplications. And in front of that is about a 15-page poem called Seasons on Earth, just to confuse you, and which is sort of a meditation on how I feel about publishing these two long poems that I wrote so long ago now, and how my life has changed, and what really remains true, and what I wrote before, and what I'm publishing now, and so on. I wrote Co, or A Season on Earth, in, what do I say in the poem? I forget. I think I was about, I'd just gotten married, so I was 29 years old. I wrote it in 1954, I guess, and 1954, and I wrote The Duplications about 15 years after that.
Would you read the introduction to these two poems that you wrote? And this you wrote very recently.
Yeah, I wrote this last year. Finished it this year, actually. This is an introduction to these two poems, but it's... I'll only read... How much did you want me to read? About 2.5 pages?
Yeah,
This is just a tiny part of it. About a tenth of it. There is a way of thinking... Oh, I should tell you that it's written in Ottava Rima, which rhymes A-B-A-B-A-B-C-C, and so you'll hear the rhyme sometimes and sometimes not. There is a way of thinking about happiness as being at one's side, so that one has but to bend or turn to get to it, and this for years I thought was true, or that a basket of sensual sensations brings a bliss that makes one as the winner is at Ascot. With Co, I had the first idea. The second, some first one too, went with the story of Papand. With strong opinions and with ignorance and with indifference and with aggression, with my own odd idea of what made sense and being happy some sort of an obsession, ignoring most contrary elements by going outside or changing the discussion, I used to live for it like cows for clover by my hot, happy sense of things bowled over. In spite of the real suffering around me and poverty and spite, I had the sense that there was something else. Each midday found me ecstatically in the present tense, writing. And you would have to come and pound me quite hard to drag me from my innocence. That sense, that now seems almost unbelievable, I love it, loved it. Is it irretrievable? Well, now at 60, please, some frankness, muse. I think about it less. It's an accompaniment of doing what I ought to do, and news affects it, and the vagaries of my temperament, to some degree unchanging. I find clues in books, in actions done, and statements somebody meant to be the truth, in love with its crescendos, and traveling sometimes, looking out the windows. There's no way now I can be quite believing all feeling will take shape, and I'll go walking up to that place where light blue air is weaving a cloud supply for birds to fly through, squawking, and that each exquisite, sensuous day or evening is an announcement of a door unlocking, inviting me to enter. Oh, my narratives that kept me thinking of such kinds of paradise. I had the thought while I was writing Co. to get into the poem every pleasure I'd ever had. The Ortopedico was down the hill, and up the hill the treasure of arms and legs that Michelangelo gave to his David, white and huge of measure. Janus and Catherine, like a Perugino, Mary and child, shared with me the Villino. I was at that time 31 or 32, even then glad I had lived so long, long enough to influence history's verdict, I still believed in that, by my big song of baseball, youth, and love. No way the Arctic of death, disease, or pain had bent the strong support floor of my being. Happiness, I thought, was what life came to, more or less.
As you've gotten older, do you feel that you've been writing about different kinds of subjects in your poems, or that your poems are more related to day-to-day reality?
Well, I have the sense that something happened in my poetry that happens to people in general. When one is young, there's this tremendous future in front of you, and it's a time for, like, you have to imagine most things because they haven't happened to you. And when you're older, there's a lot that's really happened. There's a lot of past there, and it's the influence of that gets very strong sometimes. Yeah, I think the subject of my poetry has changed at a certain point. I think at a certain point in the poems in The Art of Love, which I wrote in the early 70s, my poetry started to be increasingly about or to take into account the strongest feelings I'd had in my life and the people I cared most about and so on.
We only have a few seconds left, but one of the things I love about your poems is the meter, the rhythm, and the sometimes rhyme to it. It's something you've never given up in poetry that a lot of people have.
Well, very little of my work has meter or rhyme, but these two long poems and Seasons on Earth does. I mean, I'm glad if you like it. I'm glad if you like the music in my other poems, too.
Well, that's the thing, the sense of music in language.
Yeah.
That I think is really in your poems.
I think that's sort of what poetry is all about, no? Because at least as far as I'm concerned in writing it, unless there's some sort of music to make unexpected connections, I can only say what I know in my daily life, and that's usually not worth putting into a poem.
Kenneth Koch, we're out of time. I want to thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
My guest has been poet Kenneth Koch, and his latest book is a collection of two long poems, Co and the Duplications. The book is called Seasons on Earth. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with Hanif Qureshi. He's a British writer of Pakistani descent who wrote the film My Beautiful Laundrette. It's a comedy about racial and class oppression in England. His new film, Sammy and Rosie Get Laid, is about to open, so I hope you can join us. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio. From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Coming up, I speak with screenwriter William Goldman. He wrote Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, Marathon Man, and All the President's Men. But it took 13 years to complete the project he felt most passionate about, the screen adaptation of his novel, The Princess Bride. Also today, the Boston Herald's classical music critic Ellen Pfeiffer reviews the brief career of British cellist Jacqueline Dupré, who died last Monday. Her 16-year struggle with MS cut short her brilliant career. And for our biweekly review of home video, Ken Tucker bypasses the classics and the hit feature films and checks out some novelties. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
I'm Ann Bozell in Washington. Secretary of State George Shultz says the superpowers are, quote, virtually there on a treaty to eliminate intermediate-range nuclear weapons. But he told reporters at a news conference in Moscow today that disagreement over the strategic missile defense system is holding up plans for another superpower summit.
We have not set any date for Mr. Gorbachev's visit, although he assured us that he wishes to come and holds open the possibility of coming this year.
Gorbachev did not meet with the press following his four-hour meeting with Shultz, but the official Soviet news agency TASS said he proposed a moratorium on the production, testing, and deployment of medium and shorter-range nuclear missiles starting on November 1st. President Reagan will have to start looking for another Supreme Court nominee. Today, the Senate rejected the nomination of Robert Bork. The final vote was 58 to 42. It followed months of bitter debate about Bork, whom the president nominated 4 months ago to replace Justice Lewis Powell on the High Court. It was relatively quiet on Wall Street today after one of the wildest weeks in history. The Dow Jones Industrial Average was up fractionally to finish at 1950.76. Declines outnumbered advances by more than 2-1. For the week, the Dow lost almost 296 points, leaving the index 28% below its all-time peak reached in August. Commerce Department spokesman Robert Ortner said today he disagrees with analysts who blame this week's steep losses on the nation's trade and budget deficits.
Those two deficits have been with us a lot of years, certainly several years. And in fact, they've begun to improve this year. Why would they suddenly cause the market to go down 500 points in one day? I don't buy that.
The New York Stock Exchange closed 2 hours earlier today to allow the exchange and member firms to catch up on the paperwork generated by this week's unprecedented volume. Iran and the U.S. continued to trade threats regarding the Persian Gulf today. Defense Secretary Caspar Weinberger warned Iran that it will have to pay a high cost if it continues to attack Persian Gulf shipping. Meanwhile, Iran warned that it will launch more invisible shots against Kuwait if Kuwait continues its support for Iraq in its war with Iran. And Tehran said it has many more than 16 U.S.-made Stinger anti-aircraft missiles and that it is prepared to create an inferno for American forces in the Persian Gulf. The Department of Energy has conducted the 13th announced nuclear weapons test of the year. The underground blast rocked buildings in Las Vegas, 85 miles away. DOE officials say today's test shows that a strike by test site workers is not delaying the nuclear blast schedule. From Salt Lake City, NPR's Howard Berkus reports.
Most of the test site's 2,200 union workers have been off the job for 5 weeks. They're in the midst of a wage and benefits dispute with Department of Energy contractors, and they vowed to shut down the nation's nuclear weapons testing program. But there are more than 3,000 non-union workers at the Nevada test site, and DOE officials say they've kept the testing schedule on track. They say the schedule will be disrupted if the strike continues another 4 or 5 months. The specific purpose of today's blast is classified, but DOE officials say they tested one of the following: an old weapon from the nuclear stockpile, a safety mechanism for nuclear weapons, or a new weapons design. I'm Howard Berkus in Salt Lake City.
The Commerce Department reports strong economic growth last quarter. The gross national product expanded at a rate of 3.8%. And the Labor Department says inflation rose just 0.2% in September. I'm Ann Bozell in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Guest commentator Ellen Pfeiffer joins us today with a remembrance of the late cellist Jacqueline Dupre. Dupre died last Monday at the age of 42. She had suffered for many years from multiple sclerosis. When she could no longer perform, she channeled her energy into teaching and raising money to support research to find a cure for MS.
Certainly there has never been a shortage of musicians forced to reconstruct their lives because of disablement, which is what Jacqueline Dupre did in the 16 years between the diagnosis of MS and her death. Pianist Paul Wittgenstein lost an arm in World War I, but went on to play as a left-handed pianist. More recently, the pianists Leanne Fleischer, Gary Graffman, and Byron Janis have given up playing because of disabilities, but they've found other musical outlets in conducting and teaching. Dupre's disablement was much more complete, and in someone so vital, MS seemed a terrifyingly perverse twist of fate. I remember her performing in the late 60s. She was a lanky, big-boned girl, her blonde hair pulled back from her face, her arms bare. People called her the milkmaid. She strode onto stage with the same dynamism as her teacher, Rostropovich. And when she played, there was such a wonderful muscularity in the sweep of her bow arm, the plant of her feet, the way her knees gripped the cello. Physicality, that's what you remember about Jacqueline Dupre. Listen to the way she bites into the opening phrases in the first movement of the Dvorak Cello Concerto. Born in Oxford, England in 1945. She heard a cello on the radio when she was four, and that decided her. She must be a cellist. She won her first competition at the age of 11 and made her professional debut in 1961 at age 16. She was an immediate sensation. Her repertory included all the standard solo literature, including the Haydn, Boccherini, Schumann, and Saint-Saëns concerti. In 1967, she married the conductor and pianist Daniel Barenboim, and they often played together. Then, in 1970, she began to experience the early symptoms of her illness. During a rehearsal with the New York Philharmonic, she discovered that she couldn't feel the strings. Finally, in 1971, she was forced to retire, and by the mid-70s, she was almost totally incapacitated. But in the brief decade of her career, she established a lasting place for herself. Many of her recordings are still in the catalog, and her first recording of the Elgar Cello Concerto remains a classic. Betty's playing was always passionate and vivacious. She seemed to take great joy in performing, especially when playing with her husband. Technically, she was a natural. There were no barriers between her and the instrument. She could play anything. Her tone was more lean and brilliant than sumptuous. Sometimes it almost seemed gritty. And there was always a wonderful rhythmic alertness and energy about her playing. Late in her career, the tone occasionally sounded quavery, and the interpretation sometimes seemed mannered. But at her best, she combined fire and flair and poetry.
Ellen Pfeiffer is music critic for the Boston Herald. This is Fresh Air. The new movie, The Princess Bride, was written by my guest William Goldman, based on his novel of the same name. Goldman's screenwriting credits include Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, All the President's Men, and Harper. The Princess Bride has all the elements of a classic fairy tale: a damsel in distress, true love, sword fights, torture, miracles, and so on. But Goldman wants you to laugh while you're sitting on the edge of your seat. The Princess Bride didn't start out as a novel for grown-ups, but as a children's story for his two young daughters.
What happened was, when they were little, I guess about 1970 or 71, because I wrote the book in 72, I asked them independently, I'll write you a story, what do you want it to be about? And one of them said princesses and one of them said brides, and I said, okay, that'll be the title, The Princess Bride. And it started out as a children's book. And then what happened was, it changed on me. It did not have the notion of someone telling someone else's story so you could jump from section to section, from one good part to another. And it changed from being a children's book to being a grown-up novel, at least in my head.
Yeah, the conceit of The Princess Bride, the way you wrote the novel, is that it's a story that you were told by your father. It's a book that you were read by your father when you were young and sick in bed with pneumonia, too sick to do anything except be read to. And you loved the story so much, and the story got you excited in reading and in books, so you wanted to pass it on to your son. But you found out that the book was really boring and that your father had just read you the good parts, so your version is just the abridged version, just with the good parts.
What's extraordinary to me is the number of people who believe
that. I believed it. You know, I was reading the book.
No, it's amazing.
Oh, I thought he had two daughters. I didn't know he had a fat son.
Well, I mean, I had all these things where the names of the countries in the early part are florin and guilder, which are, you know, in European coins, and I couldn't believe that anybody would take it that part of it seriously. But I still get letters from people who say that they can't find Morgenstern in the library or something. Morgenstern being the name of the person who theoretically wrote the novel that I'm abridging, and it's the book has assumed very much a life of its own. It's my one cult book. People who like it a lot.
There's a phrase that you use in The Princess Bride, which is the good parts. To me, that's always been a phrase from erotic novels or pornography. It's the sex scenes.
Oh, I see. No, actually, the good parts, when I was writing the book, What was driving me crazy when I was starting the book was I had all these, what I hoped would be wonderful ideas for scenes, like the fencing match on the Cliffs of Insanity and stuff like that. And I didn't know how to get there. I didn't know how to jump from scene to scene to scene. I didn't know how to get there. And that's why the idea of me being told the story by my father and finding out that there were, you know, me jumping from good part to good part enabled me to write the book.
You've said that The Princess Bride is the novel that you really care about that you've written. Why do you love this novel more than other books that you've written?
Oh, I think because it changed so on me. Because I don't actually enjoy the experience of sitting down in my office alone and writing anymore. I've been doing it. I wrote my first novel when I was 24 years old, and I'm 56 now. So I've been at it a long time. And it's not a great kick to go into my room by myself anymore and write something that I know the surprises to or whatever. And what happened with Princess Bride was not only is it something different from anything I've written, it's that shift that happened, this thing that you know, where it became, it started as the one thing and became the other. And that surprised me. In other words, I was writing very, very close to my subconscious. I mean, I didn't... Usually I never show anything to anybody until I'm done. And I remember bringing home sections of it to my wife and having her read 20 and 30 page chunks and saying, "What is this?" Because it was so odd for me. And she said, "I don't know, but keep going, keep going." Once I got the idea of having the story be told to someone so I could get from one good part to the next, I just was released, and it went very quickly, and I was terribly free. And it was just a wonderful writing experience. And I wished I could have had, you know, as I say, it's the only one in over 30 years. And so I guess it holds a very special place for me.
Once your novel was finished and you liked the way The Princess Bride turned out, did you want to see it made into a movie?
Well, sure. I mean, if somebody comes to you and says, do you want to, unless you're J.D. Salinger.
I guess here's what I'm asking. How long did you shop the idea of making it into a film?
I never shopped it. You don't shop it.
Oh.
I mean, I never go around and say, hey, do you want to make a movie? I mean, I've never in my 20-some years in the picture business, I've never gone to anybody and said, hey, would you like to make a movie? They have to come to you. And somebody came to me and said, would you like to make a movie out of this? And I said I would try. And I wrote the screenplay, and he was the studio head. And he really liked the screenplay and sent me to England to work with Richard Lester, the director, who liked the screenplay. And I rewrote it for Richard Lester, and everybody was thrilled. And then the studio head was fired. And that was the beginning of the jinxing of The Princess Bride. It was a jinxed project for the next 13 or 14 years. It would almost happen and then not happen and then almost happen. I mean, several studio heads got fired after they said to me they really wanted to make it. One studio folded. There was a chance to make it in Moscow that went on for years. But I controlled the project, and no director who I wanted would go and live a year and a half in Moscow. So that never happened. But, I mean, you don't go around and say to them, here's the movie. They read it. They have readers. And then they decide to buy it or not buy it. But that's not a decision that you make.
You wrote The Princess Bride for your two daughters, and it ended up becoming an adult novel. Did your daughters like the story?
Yeah, but they have to say that. They know how, you know, yes, of course they do. I mean, but if they said no, I would basically be so crushed. I think they couldn't take that risk. I think they like the movie too, but they have to say that. Yes. Yeah, they do. I think they feel very appealed to by it.
From the movie and the book, I now have this permanent impression of you being sick in bed and having a father or a grandfather read to you from the story The Princess Bride. Did that ever happen to you, that you were sick in bed and that a relative surprised you with this great
Oh, yeah,
tale?
The pneumonia that I write about that the kid has is absolutely... I was hospitalized very badly. I almost died of pneumonia when I was a kid, I guess. I don't know if I almost died or what, but I was hospitalized for a long time with it. And just like in the book, when I couldn't get the football games on the radio on Friday, I think it was. And I kept being told the football games were on a Saturday, and I kept forgetting that, you know... That was when they found out I was delirious. Yes, it was that part. There's a lot of me in the book. I don't want to think where, but there's a lot of me in it.
The Princess Bride is your favorite of all the books that you've written, and for years it was on the verge of being made into a movie, but it didn't work out for years. Now it's worked out. It's a hit film, and in a way that closes a chapter of your life, because that's the process is completed. It is now a movie, and a successful one at that. Do you have something else to be obsessed with now?
I don't know. I didn't know that I was going to be obsessed with Princess Bride when I wrote it. In other words, I'm sure, being an obsessive type, I'll find something. But I had no idea when I wrote the book it was going to be of such import to me. And I had no idea when I wrote the screenplay. You must understand, the screenplay was written before Watergate. I mean, if Princess Bride, if Gordon Stolberg hadn't gotten fired, this movie comes out 4 years or 5 years before Star Wars. This would have been one of the first of the special effects movies in a different world. You wonder, I mean, it's so I didn't know when I wrote the screenplay back in 1973 that, or I can't remember whether 73 or early 74, whenever it was. I had no idea it would take until 1987 for the movie to get made. And after all the rejection that I had and all the close calls, and all, I never thought it would get made. I had reached the point where I was quite sure that I was going to be dogged by it for the rest of, throughout eternity. Somebody would come and say, I really want to make it, and then get fired. And the fact that it's worked after all these years is, of course, thrilling. And the fact that I really like the movie is really icing on the cake.
William Goldman, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Great.
William Goldman is the author of the novel and the screenplay, The Princess Bride. He spoke to us from his home in Manhattan. This is Fresh Air. You can hear full coverage of today's news on All Things Considered. Renee Montaigne, who co-hosts the program, is joining us from Washington. Hi, Renee.
Hi, Terry.
What story are you following?
Well, tonight we preview tomorrow's gubernatorial election in Louisiana. There, Governor Edwin Edwards is fighting for his political life. He's in the Huey Long tradition. He's flamboyant. He's silver-haired. He's been called silver-tongued as well. He's also been indicted. But this once enormously popular governor is now may lose his first election. Louisiana has fallen on hard times economically, and many voters are blaming the governor. The vote today on Robert Bork, we'll have that story. Also, we speak with Clement Haynsworth, who was nominated by President Nixon to the Supreme Court and rejected by the Senate.
Thanks, Renee. Those stories and more are coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Home video stores rent more than feature films. Critic Ken Tucker tells us what happened when he sampled some of the alternatives.
In search of something besides a new or old movie, yet not quite willing to engage in one of those Jane Fonda workouts, even that new walking one looks pretty dicey to me, I decided to check out a few novelty videos. One was a spoof of self-help videos, the other works as a party game. My first choice was Dorf on Golf, a cassette that's one of the most popular around these days. Dorf is a comic character created by Tim Conway, who seems to have fallen on hard times since his golden period on The Carol Burnett Show. In this dull-witted video, Conway walks around a golf course on his knees to impersonate a very short man. He speaks in an accent that will remind you of Lawrence Welk. The idea is to offer golf tips while making you guffaw. You'll know when to guffaw because there's a laugh track prodding you. Here's a sample.
And now we'd like to show you some of the supplementary equipment that you can purchase to help with the game of a golf of yours. First of all, this is a little arm brace that you can purchase. You see that it's adjustable. And then once you find the correct position for your elbow itself, you just lock that little dude in like that. And then it is permanently locked. You keep your hand straight when you hit that ball like that.
Now, there's even a busty woman named Boom Boom trundled in front of the camera for extra laughs. Dorf on Golf is dumb. But Dorf is Einstein compared to Murder Mystery, a video cassette with an appealing premise. The idea is to dramatize the equivalent of a mystery novel, a sort of updated Agatha Christie story set in an old country inn. A murder is committed at the start of the video, and a series of colorful suspects is introduced. You become the detective. This might have been fun, but instead it's merely annoying, starting with the instructions on how to play this murder mystery game. They're delivered by a bad actor sitting in a police station squad room.
First, there are three simple rules. Number one, each one of you will be given character cards which correspond to the character that will appear on the screen. You are that character. Number two, on your character cards, you will have three series of facts about your character under the headings first series of facts, second series of facts, and third series of facts. Now, the tape will be stopped on three separate occasions for all of you to question one another. When the tape is stopped for the first time, you can divulge, if questioned, only those facts listed under the headings first series of facts. The same applies to the tape stops 2 and 3 and to the corresponding facts.
Follow all that? It doesn't help, of course, that the script is so corny and all the actors are as bad as that one. What I find most dispiriting about videos like these is the presumption that the audience is a bunch of dummies, that you can't take in too much detail, that everything must be repeated 5 times. After enduring these cassettes, I was ready for a few movies. Among the most recent releases are Making Mr. Right, the box office bomb by director Susan Seidelman. It stars John Malkovich as a robot with a full head of hair. There's also Hoosiers, a tale of small-town basketball rescued from sentimentality by the performance of the always great Gene Hackman.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Here's a look at the next Fresh Air. Next time, I'll speak with actor Ned Beatty. Since he made his screen debut in Deliverance, he's had roles in 37 films, including Nashville, Network, and The Big Easy. Also, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead will review the new album by trombonist Ray Anderson, whose modern style is influenced by New Orleans jazz of the 20s. And television critic David Bianculli will preview Echoes in the Darkness, a CBS miniseries about the murder of teacher Susan Reinhardt and her 2 children in a Philadelphia suburb. So I hope you can join us. We'd like to hear from you. Write us with your comments and suggestions. Our address is Fresh Air, WHYY Radio, Independence Mall West, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, 19106. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller, who also directed today's show. Our producers are Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton are the production assistants. Our engineer is Richard Parker. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.